Okay, welcome everybody. Thanks for coming along to this session. I'm Jenny Lyon and we're going to be talking about data analytics. I'm just going to introduce everybody initially so that then they can just run it as we go along, and then we'll have some questions at the end and I'll remind you then to say your name into the microphone. So Mitch Prevett. Mitch co-leads the retail business area at Quantium, delivering advanced analytics to retailers such as Woolworths and large suppliers such as Procter & Gamble, Unilever and PepsiCo. Deep experience in consulting at a strategic level on pricing and promotions, forecasting, ranging and customer targeting. Before that, he led an insurance pricing business area at Quantium and was central in the development of new approaches in price optimization, risk modelling and competitor analysis. And before that, he qualified as an actuary working at PwC. And he's chairing the Data Analytics Working Group, which I'm part of. Colette Murray. Colette's background's in mathematical modelling and econometrics, and after doing an undergraduate degree in actuarial studies, she completed a PhD in economics, where she developed models to understand the investment decisions of mining companies when faced with price and geological uncertainty. Since then, she's been working consulting on large analytics projects, ranging from retail banking to health insurance. Currently a data scientist at Telstra in the big data team, where she uses statistical and machine learning techniques to drive business value from Telstra's data assets. And Stuart Stoyan is a founder and CEO of Australian marketplace lender Moneyplace. Moneyplace is an online marketplace that connects creditworthy borrowers with investors. It enables borrowers to save money with lower rates and investors to earn more through higher fixed income returns. So I'm really looking forward to hearing this. It was launched in late 2015 after becoming Australia's second fully licensed marketplace lending platform. He's a leading member of Australia's fintech community and has helped shape national fintech and innovation policies. He's a board member of Fintech Australia and a member of federal government's fintech advisory group. Before that, he was head of strategy for NAB Business. So I'm going to hand over now to Mitch, and we'll take from there. Thanks.
Thanks, Jenny. So, data analytics. It seems like such a simple term, but I guess it just seems like something that we've been doing for years as actuaries. And the truth is that there's an enormous amount of change happening in this area. It's really changing and shaping a very new space, a very different space. It's safe to say that we're going through, I guess, the biggest change that we've seen since the Industrial Revolution, and data is at the centre of it. I often talk about kind of mega trends that are happening in technology at the moment, computing power, mobile, social, and data being a huge driver of that change. So today I'm going to give a bit of a presentation on data analytics and my own personal perspective. I haven't worked in financial services for a few years now. I did scatterings of it, and I've moved into the retail space, so I'm calling myself a retail actuary. So I wanted to give a bit of experience from what I'm doing in terms of data analytics. And also, as Jenny mentioned, I work on the Data Analytics Working Group, so I wanted to give an update on where that is heading. And then Stuart will come and talk about Moneyplace, which I think is very relevant and in terms of a number of reasons. It's relevant for this conference in terms of financial services, using big data, and innovating and driving innovation in terms of new areas. And Colette is going to give us a perspective in terms of moving into this area, what it's like to actually move into data analytics from an actuarial perspective. So to start with, I guess I wanted to talk about a company that I look at a lot, Amazon. Amazon, I guess you need to think to yourself, is Amazon a retailer? And this question gets asked a lot. Are they a retailer or are they a tech company? And they would say they are a tech company, but by right they are probably one of the world's biggest retailers. Jeff Bezos is the CEO. He's got, you know, you can go to websites and look up 30 different quotes from Jeff Bezos. Very impressive guy. One of the ones that I love is he says, if you find yourself in a tight box, the only way out is often to invent your way out. And that's exactly what they do. A number of different products which you may know about or may not. Amazon Echo. Echo is this box which sits in your house. It's largely a speaker and it's connected to the internet. but it's always listening and it responds to any request that you have of it. So it is like natural language processing. It is AI. There's a whole bunch of AI algorithms behind it. And it can control anything in your house connected to all of your home devices. You can ask it any question, which it can then source from the cloud. So Amazon have been using this for a while. It's a bit of a gimmick, but I think it's showing how they are moving forward in terms of this inventing new products. One that's a bit closer to me is Amazon Dash in retail. Again, you could say this is a bit of a gimmick. I don't know if anyone's seen Dash. It probably hasn't really taken off. But what it does is you can put these little tabs anywhere in your house. So you can put them in your bathroom, in your cupboard. And essentially, this is connected to your house. And when you run out of that product, you can reorder it just by pressing on the button. So you could imagine, you know, how well this was taken up. If you've got thousands of products in your house, it didn't work so well. And obviously, in my house, I'd end up with 100 boxes of cookies ordered if the kids got hold of it. But you can see there's a lot of innovation happening in this space. Now we're starting to see smart fridges, so fridges that actually sense what products are in there. There is a version of this where it's got a scanner on it. You can actually scan your product as you put it in the fridge or as you take it out of the fridge and say, I'm out of this product, reorder me something. Another one, recently, I think this was a couple of months ago, Amazon said that they were working with Ford on connecting cars to homes. So you might just go, whatever, it's two big companies working on something. What's the real insight there? What's the excitement coming forward? I guess you can imagine your car being connected to your home. You can obviously do things like start your car before you go out to it. It can give you information about the car's maintenance and when it's required for servicing, all that sort of stuff. Once you're in the car, you could probably, open the garage door from the car very easily, or as it comes in, it can automatically do that sort of stuff. But if you start to think about putting the AI technology like Amazon Echo inside your car, then you've got the ability to do stuff when you can't use your hands. So you can order a pizza on the way home. You can just do it all by voice. You could book your parking as you're driving to the city. So a whole bunch of possibilities come out once you start to put all these things together. You could imagine that a situation where, you know, we've got driverless cars in the future and you start to run out of products and your car just will order them, your house will order them and your car will go pick them up and then bring them home, maybe. So basically Amazon, keep watching Amazon. They are pushing forward. They are a massive retailer. They just announced, I think today, that they're moving into private label products in their retail chain. So they're going to have private labeled diapers and toilet paper and all this sort of stuff. So they'll be making their own retail products. To go from a technology company to a company that is big enough to create their own products and challenge Walmart is amazing. So what does this mean from an analytics perspective? So here's a few things that I guess I see in analytics coming forward. Beacon technology, so all the stuff around in-store tracking of where people are moving within store, lots of analytics we can do around that, seeing how long people dwell in front of certain areas, which way do they shop aisles. You might think from a financial service perspective, why do they care about this stuff, but it makes a huge difference if you see how people move down an aisle and how they pick up products. So there's a whole bunch of technology that's coming out around tracking people around stores, sniffing out Bluetooth and using different sorts of algorithms to do it as well. Images. So I think analytics is going to move into images. You talk about the amount of data that's created, 2.5 quintillion bytes, whatever it is, every day. That data is mostly in images and video, and we're really not using it from an analytics perspective very much at the moment. Product images are a great example where you can actually take these, digitise them, use them in models to predict how well they uplift sales as a result. So does the shape of the box make a difference, the colouring, the style? Does it appeal to different sorts of customers? And another one, I guess, that could be in the future is around gait recognition. So I don't know if you're aware, but they can do this from a criminal identification perspective. So you can see everyone's walk is actually unique. It's as unique as your fingerprint. And from video, you can actually identify criminals based on their gait. You could do the same within store. Every store has cameras. So you could see, here's a person who came into the store, and then they've gone through the checkout, that's this person, and then they've come back two or three times a day. So you can start to get an idea for how often people are coming to stores. So technology and algorithms will advance at a rate where you won't need to install beacon technology. You won't need to track people. You'll be able to use existing infrastructure to start to track people. So there's some amazing stuff happening in analytics. I think a couple of other... So I talked about AI a little bit and the area of deep learning. Deep learning is, I guess it's a bit of a buzzword that's taking off at the moment. It is a collection of neural networks and AI algorithms, but they're being used much more than they ever were, particularly around these complex areas of image recognition, natural language processing. If you get a chance, have a look at a program, a website called Crystal Knows. That's K-E-N-O-W-S. And you can go there, log in, and as long as you've got, I think it's your LinkedIn profile, it uses AI to give you a profile of yourself. It's amazingly accurate. It'll go through and tell you on all your connections, what sort of personality you have, how you deal with people, what sort of communication styles you have. So it's AI driving that sort of information. There's a whole bunch of different technologies that are sitting out there, not just Siri and Echo and Cortana from Windows. The other one, just the last one around analytics that I think is a trend that we're going to be moving towards is analysis of extremes. I think we spend so much time, particularly in my area, analysing average customers, average segments, average sales rates, all this, everything around this mean and this average. And I think what we're going to be seeing is more people looking at extremes, because extremes can be more predictive of what's going to happen. If you're looking at market mavens, they're not the average person. They're the people who adopt first, and that's where you'll get a lot more insight as to what's going to happen in the future. Okay. I thought I'd give a bit of an example from something that we've done around cold and flu tablet demand. So this is a forecasting example where we had a particular client who said, I'd like to be able to predict cold and flu. And I expect it's probably related to a whole bunch of factors, maybe weather. That's what you'd naturally think. When it gets cold, everyone gets sick. So we started off with some modelling to say, at the customer level, when can we identify someone gets sick, and what are the things that seem to predict that happening in the next week or so, or even the next few days? At a customer level, at an individual level, it doesn't work. Not based on the data that we have, but maybe it doesn't work in general, because people don't know they're sick until they're sick. Like, they don't know that they're going to get sick. It just kind of comes on, and then they're sick. They don't start buying tissues and soup and, you know, whatever it is, decongestants, and then all of a sudden they're sick. So at the customer level, we didn't find anything. But at a cohort level or at a group level, say a store or a postcode, you see some quite amazing stuff. And you see these cross-product factors start to come through. So if we take a cold and flu sort of season, you can see our forecast or actual sales, this grey line. And if we took sort of a simple model, which is what people would normally do, just predicting based on history, you get something that might drop off quite rapidly and say, cold and flu's finished, season's over. But if you take into account all these other cross-product factors like your tissue sales, sore throat, soup, stock, all these sorts of things are predictors and would demonstrate that you get a much better model that can actually predict that the season's going to continue. What we also see is this contagion effect around regions. So as you get one region, one store starts to get cold and flu, you'll see the next store starts to get cold and flu. So we can see this from our Woolworths data, so we can actually see these contagion effects come through. One interesting thing that we learned from all this was that it's quite amazing. If you start with temperature, you'd think temperature is going to drive cold and flu. What we find is that product features are actually better at predicting cold and flu than temperature. Reason is that it's more related to how cold people feel. So it might be that the temperature's just dropped, but actually how much soup people are buying is a better indicator of how cold they feel than the actual temperature. So when we put in these sorts of factors, you find that temperature drops out. Same as something like if you're trying to predict sunscreen sales, you would find that, say, ice cream is a better indicator than temperature. So there's these sorts of cross-product factors come in. Okay, so just changing... That's just a quick intro into, I guess, the sorts of data analytics stuff that I'm doing in my space. Data analytics can be everything from sort of complex forecasting algorithms and back to, like I said, you know, very simple kind of analysis, analysing averages, analysing customer profiles and trying to understand the data. So what I wanted to do was give you a little bit of an overview of the data analytics working group I've been on for the past 18 months. How are we going for time? Just grab my phone. Okay, almost out of time. So I'll just give you a quick overview of the Data Analytics Working Group. So we set up to achieve, I guess, four main aims, been together for 18 months now and really been concentrating on, I guess, doing stuff and getting it out there. Starting with the vision, I don't think we've solved the vision. That's an ongoing thing, but we're trying to understand what's our unique, how do actuaries play in this space? What's unique for us? Education, again, not something we're going to crack straight away, but how do we start to learn what education pathways there are? What different ways can people get educated in this space? Membership engagement is where we're trying to, I guess, continue to promote. So getting people involved in this area and communicating and talking about stuff. And then employer engagement. Over time, again, just in our early days on employer engagement. In terms of activities so far, there's been a lot of work happening. CPD frameworks. We've run a conference and we're going to run a couple more this year in data analytics to get people talking. We're running some study groups. So one of the best ways to learn, there's so much free stuff you can learn online, so why should we try and create content? Instead, let's facilitate the way that people can learn. We ran a Kaggle competition, which was a really good success. Lots of participants and a couple of winners from Deloitte. The LinkedIn group, really want to promote the LinkedIn group. If you've got ideas and you want to participate, jump on the LinkedIn group, comment, like, share, all sorts of information that you find interesting. We're doing some stuff around employer research, and then I guess we need to, you know, get this all together into Microsite going forward. So lots of activities. Our plan is just, it's a working group, so we're just trying to get stuff done, and then over probably the end of this year, thinking about where does it go from here going forward. I will not take up any more time. That was my intro. I'll hand over to Stuart. Cheers.
Thank you, first of all, for having me along. Really good to be able to talk about MoneyPlace and also marketplace lending. Just out of interest, who's heard of marketplace lending or peer-to-peer lending? Few hands. Who's had a personal loan or has a personal loan right now? Maybe had some credit card debt they don't necessarily want to admit to because they went a little bit crazy in Europe. There are some nervous glances sideways. So I'm going to take that. You get the general concept of consumer debt. So we start out with the basic proposition. Consumer lending's broken in Australia. And most people kind of get that when you point out some of the key facts. And there are really three sort of key tenets to this. And the first is limited choice. Most of the banks run a one-size-fits-all view to pricing. So a personal loan is going to be 14 or 15%. You know, credit cards, 20, 22%. No matter who you are, no matter which bank you bank with. Now, if you look to the person to your left and you look to the person to your right, I'm pretty sure you're better credit than the people either side of you. So why is it that you're carrying that person on your left? Why is it that you're getting the same interest rate when you should actually be entitled to getting a fairer, better rate that represents you? Second point to this is price discovery. There's no price discovery in financial services, specifically in consumer lending. So if you think of any other industry, you think of retail, you think of, you know, you think of the cafe just across the road. If you went to your cafe and said, I'd love to get a latte, and they go, it's $20, thank you. You go, no, that's all right, I'll go to the next one. I'll get one for $3.50. In consumer lending, you don't actually get the price confirmed until you've applied for a loan and essentially are a couple of steps away from signing up. And by then it's too late because the bank's already impaired your credit record and said that you applied for a loan. So why is it that we're in this sort of industry where price discovery, that basic tenet of sort of consumer rights, isn't available for anybody to get a sense for what a loan should cost? Second challenge then is, the reason why, is there are massive spreads in the industry. So what this shows is the average credit card rate, the average personal loan rate, and then an average term deposit rate over the last 25 years. And so what you see is the spread has doubled. So the difference between the sort of, you know, the lending rate and essentially the deposit rate has doubled. And so it's doubled for credit cards going from 900 basis points to just under 1800 basis points, and for personal loans from 650 to just under 1200. And so you're in this environment, and this is the second reason why consumer lending is broken, is it's really expensive. And that's in an environment where we've got the lowest mortgage rate since the 1950s. You know, we've got a cash rate that is now sub 2%. So why is this, and what is it that's going on that says that this product is more expensive than anything else? And you start to get an answer when you look at bank profits. And this is not beating up on banks because it's large. This is beating up on banks because they're profiteering in consumer lending. Unsecured personal loans, you know, credit card debt, 3% of total loans. But it's 7% of profit and 11% of risk-adjusted profit. Risk-adjusted profit being consumer lending is less risky than business lending is less risky than... So there are some, you know, adjustments and whatnot the banks like to make. So what is it, though, that means that you're able to get four times effectively the profit out of an asset base that's sort of 3%? That just, again, doesn't make sense. And so for these reasons, lack of choice, you know, an increasing spread and a gouging, I guess, of profit, that suggests that consumer lending's not working. So what do you then have? You've got a company like MoneyPlace, and there are other peer-to-peer lenders or marketplace lenders that are also described. And so we exist so that we can actually provide fairer, better rates to borrowers, but also to enable investors to be able to invest in the loans to borrowers and thus getting a better fixed income return. And so what this means is that we're a marketplace. We're a dual-sided marketplace that sits in the middle, that connects the credit-worthy borrowers. So we do the credit assessments, and I'll get to that because that's sort of the data bit and the innovative bit. But, you know, we assess credit-worthy borrowers. We identify them, and then we match them in to investors who've specified an investment appetite. I'm interested in investing in A, B, or C-grade loans, you know, expecting this type of return. Match me in and make it happen. Two really simple propositions. On the investor side, get better returns than you get from any other sort of fixed income investments. But on the borrower side, comes back to you and the two people on your left and right. Get an interest rate that's bespoke to you, that reflects you and represents the interest rate that you truly present. And so then, how do we do that? Gets to a user experience. The bit that I was kind of polite about before in terms of why consumer lending is broken, if anybody's ever applied for a loan or tried to interact with their bank, and I'm pretty sure there are some people from banks in the crowd, it's a pretty horrible user experience. And so what we do is we've designed a seamless user experience that enables you to apply for a loan and interact with MoneyPlace across a spectrum of devices when and how you see fit. You can get, and on that price discovery point, you can get an estimate as to how much a loan would cost you in 60 seconds. You might do that on your iPhone or your smartphone on the train on the way into work. You get into work, you know, maybe hit a tea break or a lunch break. Maybe you start typing out a loan application on your desktop at work. And then you get home and you might finish that on your iPad. Now, this is about creating a user experience that enables you to apply for a loan when and how you see fit in a way that's suitable for you. The effort that you require to understand price is 60 seconds. If you then want to complete an application, it's an 8 to 10 minute application process. And then we run a fully automated loan sort of, you know, first of all from a credit decision process, but then from a loan approval and loan origination process. That means you can effectively get your money in the next 24 to 48 hours. Again, it's focused about you. This is about banking in a way that applies to you, in a way that you want to do it, and not necessarily us imposing just because we've got 50-year-old stodgy systems that were built in COBOL. Means that you have to go through hoops and hurdles to be able to bank with us. So that's the user experience. But the juicy bit, and apologies for the green here, they dropped the slides into the Institute's template, and it turns out the green's the colour that matters most. But this is the data bit, and this is the borrower innovation. This is risk-based pricing. And so what you have here, in the middle in the blue boxes, that's the information that banks use. Application form information, that's the stuff that you self-declare. Yes, I earn $1 million. Of course I do. No, I don't have any other debts. Of course I do. You get the existing customer data. That's relevant, though, only if you're an existing customer. And then finally, you get the bureau information. In the interests of probably offending people, anybody from Vita or Dun & Bradstreet in the room? Awesome. So the bureaus are doing a horrible job in Australia at the moment because we don't have comprehensive credit reporting. And comprehensive credit reporting gets to being able to pull together all the information about you that reflects you as an individual as to how you've performed. At the moment, we're in a negative reporting environment. So if you don't pay a bill, that gets recorded. But what about the fact that you've paid your bill on time for the last 10 years? Or what about the fact that you've never had a loan, so there's no credit information, but you've been paying your Telstra bill, for example, or you've been paying your other utility bills on time? Isn't that useful information? And so that's the problem with the current environment, is it's stacked against the consumer. And so banks and that existing customer data is really what they lean on, because banks will reject 70 to 80% of applications that are new to bank. So if you're not an ANZ customer or a CBA customer, and you apply to CBA in this instance, they're going to decline you 4 out of 5 times. So what do we do at MoneyPlace? We use data, and thus the kind of long, roundabout, sort of slippery slope way of getting to the point of the discussion today. We use data in ways that banks can only imagine that they would like to use data. We have a team of people who are ex-Big Four banks who've been working in unsecured lending for a number of years. And this is essentially Disneyland for anybody who's worked in consumer credit. And why is that? It's because the insights that you can glean from all these other data sources. So first of all, we look at bank account data, not just because we don't have a bank, you know, we're not a bank, so we don't have customer data as extensive as sort of a Big Four banks do. So what we do is we use Yodlee to be able to screen scrape and to be able to capture transactional data. From that, we can look and model your life. Do you get paid on the first of the month? Do you spend it all on the second of the month and then live like a pauper? Or is there a nice little sort of curve that goes down that shows that you're actually a little bit prudent? Do we see risky transactions? Those online gambling debts that you seem to rack up at sort of 3 a.m. in the morning, that's something that gets flagged. Or those ATM withdrawals that you make on for your Visa card, that also gets flagged as being a risky transaction. And so this information gleans insight about your behaviour and your profile. We then look at other things like telco data. What's the ability of you to be able to, you know, pay your bill on time, for example? And Telstra's sitting on an absolute minefield of data that's there that is ready to be tapped into, provided Telstra can navigate, one, how to monetize it, and two, how to navigate the privacy. But if you also think about some of the data that sits, say, inside, Telstra's servers around where do you move? Do you take your phone into work every day and then come home every day? And is that a common behaviour? Or is the phone now often in Mexico? You know, what does that suggest about your ability to generate income? And if you're still in Mexico a month later, does that mean you're going to come back and earn your income and make your loan repayment? Or how do you then play that information through? We use things like device data, particularly from an anti-fraud perspective. So are you applying on an iPhone that's in Melbourne CBD and is often frequently in Melbourne CBD and therefore has a unique sort of geolocator that says that that's where it's at? Or is this going through a myriad of servers and VPN masking devices that essentially originates from Eastern Europe or Russia? We're looking at things like, we've got over 300 data points around this, things like refresh rate, response rate. Are you using the current version of iOS, or are you using a version that's 5 generations old? Have you done anything to your device? What is it that's running on it that sort of suggests that maybe this could lead to fraudulent activity? We look at app form use, we look at social media. So app form use we look to a little bit more sophisticated than what banks are doing. You know, how is it that you applied for your loan? Did you say, give me as much money as possible for as long as possible, yes, 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 apply? Or did you actually sit there and think about it? I would like, if I reduce the amount, then I can afford that a little bit more. If I increase the term, my repayments come down, it's a little bit more considered. From social media, we're using social media from an anti-fraud perspective at the moment, but might get to a credit perspective, which could be horrifying for a number of people. From a fraud perspective, it's really about scanning 30 different social media sites to say, do you exist? Now, if you're not existing, that's not necessarily a bad thing if you're 68 years old and living in Boronia, but if you're 22 years old and maybe you should have a social profile, that comes up as a red flag as to maybe this is a procured identity. Maybe it's something that somebody's sort of, you know, curated over the last 6 months. We get to things like email and email data. So is this a burner email address? How old is this email address? Is it stuart.stoyan@, or is it happypants77qbfzp3? Which starts to again get to the integrity of the application. And so all of this is ways that we're able to use data that enables us to give you, a borrower, a fairer, better rate. But also, it enables investors to have more certainty around the volatility, or rather the lack of volatility and the return that they're getting. Tertiary data is the last one I'll just sort of touch on. And this is really interesting. We're not doing this yet, but overseas in the United States, there are marketplace lenders who are using tertiary course information. And so the way that you use this is for student loans in the US, the default rate's about 15%. Top 100 schools, 2%. Top 50 schools, 1%. Top students in the top courses of the top 50 schools, basis points. And so this gets to solve for that issue sort of before around the bureau information that's available, is that you have a lot of people have got thin files. So there's a lack of information that's available on you just because you haven't been a participant, you haven't borrowed before. But why shouldn't we be able to use your tertiary course information if that gets you a better rate? If you've got a good job and gone and joined a great firm like Quantium, for example, wouldn't that suggest that you would be more creditworthy than somebody who is working at, I don't know, Deloitte? But that then gets to the ability to be able to use information about you in a way that gives you access to a rate that you deserve. So to flip on then just in terms of the Australian opportunity, just to give some context around that, we see that the market in Australia is a $250 billion addressable market, consumer loans and then also small business loans. We focus solely on consumer lending. Now, the estimates are around about 20% penetration. So that's, if you go back to the 1990s, sort of early 2000s, non-bank mortgage providers, Aussie Home Loans, RAMS and all that, that kind of gets to the ability to be able to say, we're getting 20% sort of share of the market. So off of those numbers, this is a $50 billion opportunity. To date, less than $100 million has gone through marketplace lenders. The runway is therefore massive, and the lovely folk at Morgan Stanley estimate $10 billion in consumer lending will go through marketplace lenders by 2020. So that gets to a significant opportunity that all hinges around the ability of us to be able to use data in a more sophisticated way that essentially comes down to a credit decision that says, are you a good lender, are you a bad lender? Really, really simple stuff, but just done in a much more advanced and sophisticated manner. So that's it. I've got that slide up there for questions. Feel free to copy contact details if you want to get in touch. But I know we're going to do a Q&A after this, so then we'll flip over and then we'll come back. But thank you very much.
So my name's Colette, if anyone's forgotten. So today we've heard some incredibly exciting examples of how data and analytics is being used to change the world that we live in and make it a better place, I think. But there's a field underlying all of this. There's a group of people actually doing this exciting work, and this field is data science, and these people are generally called data scientists. So I'm here to talk about my journey from starting out in actuarial and now working as a data scientist at Telstra and what I've learned throughout this process. Yeah, so originally I started in actuarial science, and I absolutely loved statistics and maths and modeling. And then from there on, I moved on to economics, where I got to sink my teeth into some really interesting problems. I did a PhD on mining companies and tried to understand how they would make decisions about where they would invest. And I got to look at geological information, pricing information, inventories, production. And it was really in this process when I was pulling together lots of different data sets, trying to understand the complexities of how decisions are made, that I developed my passion for data and for analytics and finding insights that actually have value from data. So today I'm going to talk a bit more about that. So a lot of people have heard about data scientists. I think we've all heard things such as in 2012, the Harvard Business Review dubbed data science as the sexiest profession of the 21st century, which was quite exciting for me coming from actuarial science to suddenly be working in the sexiest profession. we also hear things such as there's a global shortage of data scientists and companies just cannot hire these people fast enough. They can't find the people to do the work that they want to do. And we hear that data science is solving critical problems from areas such as medical research through to marketing, banking, finance, mining and production. So we hear a lot of great things about it, and it sounds like an interesting and exciting field. But what is it actually? What does a data scientist actually do? What are the skills that you need to do this job? And how can someone become a data scientist? Up until very recently, no universities were offering courses in data science. So how do you get into this kind of role? So I'll start off with, what is a data scientist? So at the moment, if you were to go Google, what is a data scientist, you'll find lots of different definitions of what it is. So there really isn't a clear definition. The best way I can describe it is that it's an intersection of many fields. It's an intersection of statistics, data engineering, algorithms, behavioral economics, computer science, and general business expertise. But what I really think is that at the core, data science is being able to identify a business problem and then going out and identifying the relevant and available data and using this data to create actionable insights that we can use to solve the business problem. And what I want to focus on there is the actionable insights, which is something I'm going to come back to later again. All right, so this might sound exciting, but what do you actually need to do? I still haven't really answered that question. What do you need to know to do this job? And I think there are three broad skill sets that anyone entering a data science role needs to have. And the first set is IT and computer science skills. Now, for me, coming from a statistical, actuarial, economics background, this is where I was really lacking in skills when I first got to this area. So any company would expect you to have an understanding of relational databases and how they work and how you would query and use it. So the main language for querying any relational database is SQL, and that's really where I would recommend anyone starts. How can you derive any insights from your data if you can't even access it or look at it in exciting ways? But then on top of being able to just query the database, we also want to do analytics, and that requires knowing one of R, Python, or SAS. There's many other languages as well, but those are really the three big ones that are commercially being used at the moment to do analytics. And I've developed an absolute love for coding. I find it so exciting and so exhilarating working through a problem and coming up with a piece of code to solve it. It's sometimes a daunting process to start with, but once you've started, it's so much easier to pick up new languages. But these days now, we also live in this world of big data. Relational databases and these other tools have sometimes now been associated with what we would call small data. And because of all the amounts of data that we're amassing, this has led to a need for distributed computing and distributed computing solutions. Now, not many companies in Australia are as yet using this kind of software, but it's becoming a lot more common. And that's things such as Hadoop to store your data, and software such as Hive and Spark to be able to do your analytics on top of that. So these are some really important skills that anyone going in data science requires. But something I think I didn't even initially realize at the start that is equally as important as doing exciting things such as building models using Spark is data visualization. And that's something that really drives the value of data home to people who don't come from an analytics or a statistical background. And this could be using tools such as Tableau or ClickView. There's a whole range of them out there, or even just using ggplot in R. But this is a very key role of anyone in data science. So the second major skill set, I would say, is an analytical skill set. And this is where people from an actuarial background or a finance background are incredibly strong. They do have a very strong knowledge of statistics and analytics. For me, there was a little bit of work to get across some of the latest machine learning algorithms, which I hadn't done before. Mitch mentioned deep learning, which is one of the new exciting techniques out there, but also understanding things like random forest, neural nets. What are their advantages? How can we use them? How do they compare to the more traditional kind of analytics and statistics? That is a place where people from this kind of background really shines and can really contribute a lot. And then the third set of skills, which is the skill set that really sets data scientists apart from just an analyst or just a modeler, is general business skills. This is being able to jump into a problem, be so curious that you can build up all the required industry knowledge that you need to answer your problem and to develop a story around your data. There's no point building an incredible, complicated model if you can't translate it into insights that can be used, if you can't make the data and the story real to the business. That is what set data scientists apart from anyone else. So this might sound incredibly daunting. It might sound like a lot of things that you need to be across and a lot of things that you need to be able to do. But it really isn't as bad as that, and there is so much help out there at the moment. One of the advantages of data science being the sexiest profession of the 21st century. The first place I would send anyone who wants to know more about this is Coursera or edX as well. There are so many online courses about data science, starting from really basic introductions all the way through to quite complicated algorithms, database structures, and even coding. This is the best source for information out there. Then there are also some online coding tutorials, such as Code Academy is great for learning SQL or Python, a whole range of other languages as well, and DataCamp is very good for learning R. And a bonus as well is all of these resources are free. As Mitch mentioned as well, Kaggle is a great way to get your teeth into a real problem that a business has, a real data set, and you stand the chance of winning some money out of the process as well. But don't sell short things such as the professional communities here in Melbourne. The Data Analytics Working Group sounds like an incredible opportunity to actually try and do this kind of thing. There's also an active data science community in Melbourne, and I'm sure in Sydney as well. In Melbourne, we have data science meetups, which have regular hackathons, which give you a chance to try your skills against other data scientists out there. So there really is a lot of support for this field and a lot of interest in it, and it's not that hard to get into it. And probably some of my concluding thoughts on data science is, at present, especially in Australia, data science has been dominated by people who've come from engineering or computer science backgrounds. And the reason why I think that's happened is people from these backgrounds have quite strong coding skills and a lot of comfort with computers, with software, and in the integration of different types of software. I know when I started out, that was somewhere where I felt really insecure. But I see the focus shifting in the future. A lot of companies are now at the point where they've built platforms, they've built data sets, and they've got data sitting there crying out to be used, but they don't really know how to use it. They don't know how to identify what are the business problems that we can actually solve, that we can actually action, and how can we use the information that we have to do it. And that's really an incredible opportunity out there in the market right now for anyone who has those kind of skills, who has that interest, and who has that passion. And even though there's a lot of different topics to get across, I say the most important skill that you need to have going into data science is just a willingness to learn, because this is a space that's continuously evolving. There's always a new piece of software, a new algorithm, a new way to do something. And it's that desire to learn that will make you an excellent data scientist and make it a very rewarding career as well. Thanks very much.
Thank you all. Those were great presentations. Thank you. So I'm going to open up to questions. We've got about 10 minutes. Please say your name into the microphone because we're being recorded. Thanks. Julia?
Hi, everyone. Julia Lessing from Guardian Actuarial. Thank you for a really, really interesting presentation and three really outstanding speakers. I'm an actuary, but most of my work these days focuses around the use of data analytics to identify risk factors for vulnerable people and vulnerable communities, so in the human services and social services sector. And one of the challenges that we find is that, as you guys mentioned, a lot of people are collecting data. There's lots of data being collected. But one of the biggest challenges in being able to really use that well is being able to connect the data and get that single person view, that client-centric or person-centric view. So, Stuart, I was really interested in your slide that had, you know, as a prospective borrower, you want to look at whether or not I'm paying my phone bills and whether or not I'm doing all these other things. How and what sort of ways have you found have been useful in getting over those obstacles of not being able to access that data, but to be able to bring it together and really being able to analyse it well?
Yeah, absolutely. Really good question. I think it sort of gets to one of the core themes that's come through. Is big data's been around and it's talked about, but it's not how big your data is, it's how you use it. And that's the real challenge today. Yeah, those data sources that we had up on that slide are things that we're using in different ways, and some of them are fully on and fantastic. Others have limited data sets, so banking feeds, for example, we get 3 months of banking feeds. Yodlee's just launched a 12-month API in the United States. That should hopefully be here next quarter in Australia. But if you think about the power of being able to look at that information, that's really helpful and almost more powerful than a credit file, for example. And so I think that the answer is it's patchy, and therefore you need to be flexible in terms of the way that you use the information. The key for us, though, is not to let any one data point dominate in the sense of if there's no answer on this, then that's a decline. Because I think that's falling into a trap the banks sort of fall into, which is if you don't bank with us, then we're not going to lend you money. So what you therefore get to is how can the models be flexible enough to be able to be agile and move across different aspects of the data spectrum, recognizing that different customers are going to have different data profiles themselves. So if you're sort of working specifically with people who are sort of socioeconomically disadvantaged, well, that really gets to understanding in a traditional sense, if somebody's been in arrears and past 90 days due on a bill or something, then they get penalized quite significantly. So how do you look through that and then say, well, is that just an isolated incident and is it explainable and what can you do around that? Now, we haven't got a solve for that yet. We've got something that's getting towards the point, but I think it's very much an evolving space. And, you know, there are other companies alongside MoneyPlace that are doing some really cool things in this space. And hopefully what that does is it just increases accessibility to finance. And that's the most important thing, as opposed to just taking a very traditional view around this is what a borrower should look like.
Hi, this is Rev Tam. Just a question, maybe it's all brought a bit more to Mitch. It's about sort of privacy of data. So I found it a bit freaky to know if a supermarket's tracking me, walking around their store, how long I'm spending on things. And as a broader perspective, what's sort of the protections out there for the public? And you mentioned sort of the gate technology as well, being as good as the fingerprint. There's obviously protections on who can access our fingerprints to sort of know where we're using it. And just one final comment we don't go into a supermarket and sign a user acceptance form. We just sort of walk in and assume that we're sort of in a safe place.
Good question. I was waiting until privacy would come up. Mitch took two questions, so that's good.
Mitch has actually just noted you down. It's gone into a dark. If you go to Woolworths, you're screwed.
So the first thing to say is, like, we absolutely believe in privacy, and I think that's where these things get confused. Using data at an individual level and privacy are two different things. We completely respect people's privacy, and what that means is that we can never identify any individual person. There's no possibility that we can find you or anyone else in our databases. The only thing we can do is identify this is an individual who comes in and shops, and this is their basket. And down to the level where we know that they live in a local area, but we never know exactly who that person is. And that's what I think people don't realise from an outside point of view. There's a lot of people who are kind of very concerned about their own information and how it gets used. And I think that set of people, they have their own recourse. They can actually not opt into various databases, so they don't opt into a loyalty scheme. So we can never know who you are unless you've actually opted into some sort of a scheme where that person can be identified, okay? From our point of view, there's a lot of... Stuart talked about matching, and there was a good question on matching earlier on, and there are a lot of advances at the moment in terms of coming up with the best ways to match between data sets. That is all completely privacy compliant. It's all based on hashed identifiers. So essentially, you encode everything and match it at an encoded level. So I think from a privacy perspective, everyone gets a little bit scared when you first hear about this sort of stuff. And I think maybe they know all that about me in particular. But as we said, no one can be individually recognised. I think what we're also seeing is, over time, there's a growing group of people who really appreciate these schemes. It's hard to believe, but there are junkies out there who love loyalty schemes and they love the benefits they get from it. And they want to be in it as many as possible. And they realise that their data is actually being used to give them better offers, and that is actually growing quite rapidly over time.
Yeah, just a thought on that as well, and the key is there's an onus on us as data professionals or you know, now the sexiest profession of the 21st century around ensuring that that we're using data responsibly as well. So to pick an example, if you're tracking gait of somebody's walk, that's to identify a behaviour and potentially flag an issue. But if that then says that somebody walks this way is therefore a criminal and that person gets treated differently and pounced on by security guards, that's a very different scenario. And so it's the way that you actually then use the data. From a credit perspective, we can use data to say this is what a creditworthy borrower looks like, but that also gets towards redlining as well. If we say that somebody that looks like this, this and this can't get a loan, then you potentially carving out a sort of a cohort of the population and basically saying we won't lend to you and it's discriminatory. So there very much is an onus and a responsibility on us to be able to do it in a responsible manner.
Now, we've really run out of time, but if we have one quick question, we can go for it. Okay, but we'll have to be really quick or I'll be in trouble. Thank you.
Hi, it's Rizwan. So I just wanted to know the decline rate for Money Place.
Are you in the market for a loan? Is that the question?
No, I'm not.
Are you one of those pesky Deloitte people? No.
No, I'm not.
So our decline rate has actually been pretty significant. So about 60% of people who come through for an estimate aren't eligible and don't meet our criteria. We then take the 40% through, and we're probably seeing that of those that apply, we're running about 20-25% of loans at the moment. We're building that out, and I think a lot of that is also because we're a new platform and we're targeted at the moment purely online and digital. In the first few months, we've seen all sorts of applications from people, and you look at the credit file, you know, who literally have been declined 30 times in the last 12 months. And that's for good reason, because they're not creditworthy. So I think what we'll see is that over time, and it's probably going to take us 12 to 18 months, that'll start to normalise and we'll start getting better better approval rates. But for the time being the new lender on the block, we're sort of seeing everything.
Thanks. Thank you. Please thank our presenters who have done a fantastic job. Thank you all.